and directs the activities of 9 nonprofit companies operating in 9 states and the District of Columbia. That makes you say, phew. Kind of gets tired just reading and thinking about all that. In his private sector business capacity, Mr. Bryant serves as Chief Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the Bryant Group of Companies Incorporated, a privately held business involved in several business partnerships. Mr. Bryant has served on several corporate boards, including the Corporate Board of Directors for 3 Days Lines Incorporated and Southern Pacific Bank, and currently serves on the Community Board for Wells Fargo and Company, the Telecommunications Consumer Advisory Panel, and the Board of Governors of the Kravis Leadership Institute at Claremont McKenna College. Viewing community service as important, Mr. Bryant was the co-founder and the first president of the New Leaders Organization, a group of African-American professionals in Los Angeles. A lover of international art and African culture, Mr. Bryant formed Bryant Group Africa following his inaugural trip to Africa in 1997. BGA represents the Bryant family's growing collection of original Shona stone sculpture art from Zimbabwe, Africa. If you go to the Dunn Road site, you can see some of ours too. Amen. Mr. Bryant serves on the Board of Trustees for First A&E Church, the oldest black church in Los Angeles, California. I think they call it fame.
That's right.
Amen. The National Board of the Black Leadership Forum, the Board of Governors for the City Club on Bunker Hill, the Board of Directors of the Southern California Committee for the Olympic Games, the National Honorary Board of the Underground Railroad Freedom Center, the Advisory Board for the FAME Renaissance Program, the Center for Community Partnership at UCLA, and the John and Sheila Kennedy Bryant Family Foundation. John Bryant was born on February 6, 1966 at Good Samaritan Hospital in Los Angeles, California. And he resides with his wife, Mrs. Sheila Janine Kennedy Bryant. We want to present to you our speaker, well-accomplished speaker today, Mr. John Bryant. Give a round of applause.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I know I was going to have any church this morning. Or shall I say church? Thank you, Pastor Bobo. And I can't go too far without thanking Dinah. I never met this woman before in my life, but my office staff is intimately aware. You see, Dinah does not have a self-esteem problem. She doesn't take no for an answer. It appears my office said no, John's not available to speak. He's got 3 states to be in next week and just came back from Europe 3 times in January and 6 times in Washington. The man's tired. Can't go on a Saturday. Dinah didn't hear any of that. And so I am here. I think we all owe her a round of applause. I'm honored to be here. Reverend Bobo's vision is extraordinary, and you'll begin to see how extraordinary as I get into my remarks. First thing I have to say is no good deed shall go unpunished. You see, I came in last night through Denver, and somewhere in my connection, I went one way, and my bags went another. And being in the zone of God never gave anybody else anything he wanted me to have. And so you're always present in the moment, exactly where you're supposed to be. I figured God just wanted me to look cool for you this morning. So I had my jeans, my Sean John jeans out, and my oversized leather jacket from Italy I picked up, and my leather vest and my silk shirt, and my cross from the Vatican that I picked up that they blessed. I said, well, maybe this is just the way I'm supposed to roll today. Want to make God laugh? Tell him your plan. But it does prove that the calmest place in the hurricane is the center.
Yes.
The scientific fact. Most people run away from the hurricane. But if you stay centered, and that saying, if you want to pray, why worry? If you're going to worry, why pray? You stay centered, you understand that the calmest place of that hurricane is the center. You will not be harmed if you stay centered. So I got in my hotel about 1:30 in the morning. United Airlines told me I have the bag would be. Well, they said one bag would show up at 8 in the morning. The other bag didn't know where it was. And I said, well, I speak at 9. We'll try to get it to you. So I go to the hotel. Again, positive perspective is very important. I go to the hotel, and the doorman, never be presumptuous. The doorman, a brother, that's black, anybody know? I'll do some translation here from time to time. The doorman said, can I help you? Now, that's a dangerous question to a brother who just lost his bag. I said, well, probably not. I lost my bag. I'm sorry, the airline lost my bag. Well, what do you need? Come on, man. It's 1:30 in the morning. What do you mean, what do I need? And whatever I need, you can't get it before 9 in the morning. Do you know he took me into the gift shop, opened the store in the hotel, and got me a French cuff white shirt in my size. And before I left the hotel this morning, the airline called me and said, your bag is in a cab with a brother with dreadlocks and orange glasses. And he's probably gonna look a little strange in front of the Ritz-Carlton, so you may want to go out and meet him. But your bag is there. I'm here. Brought me off at the wrong end of the campus. The devil's busy. Brought me off at the wrong end of the campus. Sweet young lady says, oh, it's a short walk. For a student. She meant well. Okay. You've already figured out that I'm not your normal kind of speaker. I didn't come all this way. And believe me, I came this way lovingly coerced by Diamond. But I didn't come all this way intentionally, on purpose, and voluntarily, in all sincerity, to talk at you. I came to talk with you. And so, I've got low self-esteem, so I'm going to need to know from time to time that you're with me. Now, I'm going to come at a couple of topics hard, fast, and direct. Hard, fast, and direct. I may say some things in a way in which you have not heard it and may not be used to. If you've got a note and a pad and a piece of paper, I suggest you take it out. I don't normally take this much time to lay out an agenda. But I've been told by Reverend Bobo, who's been focusing on this issue all month, who stood in the pulpit with chains on, who cut up credit cards, I've been told that he's serious about this business. Or as they say where I came from, this business. In all seriousness, we're going to deal with this in a substantive way. I don't know if anybody's seen the show Charlie Rose. It's a talk show. But Charlie Rose, in contrast to the nightly news where they do a 2-minute soundbite, Charlie Rose will sit with his guests and they'll have a conversation. And they'll lay out an agenda. We're going to lay out an agenda today. Is that okay?
Amen.
Now, professors, I want you all to keep me honest. 10 minutes before I need to stop, I need y'all to raise your hand. I am from the AME Church, Doctrine of Public Speaking. Be good, be quick, and then be gone. But I get passionate, so I need you to give me the 10-minute mark. What I'm here to talk about today is the wealthless power. The first thing we have to do is be honest with ourselves. The wealthless power. Black America. Before I get into this, let me frame my perspective. I believe there's a lot of love in the word no. I love you, but you need to go get a job. I love you, but if you're going to do the crime, you dang well going to do the time. I love you, but if you're going to have these nappy head kids, you're going to take care of them. I love you, but you cannot pimp in my community. Worse, you can't pimp my community. I love you, but if you're going to call yourself a community leader, there has to be some community results. PhDs are good, PhDs are better. There's a bishop in LA, H.H. Brookins, Bishop H.H. Brookins, he would say, if you think you're a leader and you turn around and there's no one behind you, you're not a leader, you're just a guy out taking a walk. So I'm hard on people who purport to be leaders. I have certain standards for those who purport to be parents. I even have a standard for somebody who purports to be a human being. Watch how you live your life. It may be the only Bible that anybody else reads. Back to the topic. As I get into this, understand the premise. You don't do business with governments or companies. You do business with people. The wealthless power. Black America. Ever since the broken promise of 40 acres and a mule, African Americans have been roaming lost amidst the economic wilderness of a democratic America rooted in capitalism. As a result, African Americans today are the only modern race of people in the world that created a political power base before we created an economic one. Now, there's coffee in the back. I just hit you with something, and I'm not sure it got there. So we need to pipe in the coffee, get the tea going. I'm gonna come at you again with that. We're the only modern race of people in the world today who created a political power base before we created an economic one. Adding insult to injury, American public policy making is today, as it always has been, primarily about protecting, securing, and encouraging the growth of the stake by the economic stakeholder and the income producer, who also happens to be the taxpayer. Now, if you don't have a stake, chances are you're eating beans. What am I saying? Who's rewarded in America today? Think about public policy. Homeowners get tax breaks. The middle class and the upper class get tax breaks. Corporations get tax breaks. The guy on the street corner, homeless, don't get any breaks. American for public policy is about protecting and encouraging the stakeholder. We're a democracy rooted in capitalism. Now you can complain about that and get on the boat and go to Haiti. Or we can deal with that and understand that is the reality in this country, which I happen to believe with all our faults is the greatest country in the world today. Missing the critical step of economic empowerment, ownership, and the power of individual property rights early in our developmental process, we wholeheartedly embrace the first true mainstream power that seemed to emerge from the fruits of the civil rights movement, political power.
But political power without the underpinning of economic empowerment is a car without an engine. Again, public policy in America is principally designed around America's first priority, economics and ownership. Can I get some water, by the way, from someone? Individual property rights. Think about it. From tax breaks and other protections for homeowners, to incentives to the working class, to incentives for small businesses and corporations alike, it's all about owners and producers. There's two types of people: owners, producers, and consumers. Now, do we really care if we have a tax break unless you've got a job? I mean, do you really care about a bond issue for infrastructure repairs unless you own a home or a business? Thank you. You may not even know what they are talking about. It may be a foreign language to you unless you are an owner. And so as a result, we have effectively tied one hand behind the collective backs of our political leadership, forcing them to pursue a doomed public policy strategy, not of proactively protecting, enhancing, and growing our individual property rights, but rather a reactive, defensive strategy of trying to protect and preserve an ever-decreasing pool of entitlements and subsidies. I tell you, some folks may not like what I have to say. Ready, fire, aim. As a direct result of public policy debates, of this public policy debate in America, we are always what I call now lovingly backwards. Somewhere along the line, we confuse producing in the private sector with mandating in the public sector. We send our best public policy thinkers and idealistic doers not to create new opportunity and prosperity policy for us, but rather the thankless task of protecting an ever-decreasing level of subsidy with no dignity attached. Crumbs from a table complete with all three courses. What we could have done right if treated right. What would have happened if the promise of 40 acres and a mule was kept following the assassination of President Lincoln? I assume everybody knows about 40 acres and a mule that followed Civil War. What if blacks worked the land of their own real property as a unified family unit following the slave era? We get all mixed up and caught up with whether I like you. What does like have to do with it? It's okay if you don't like me. I like me. So what if we were producing crops and trading, selling, and building a net worth on our own land following the Civil War, developing an ethic truly tied to outcomes? Now, what do I mean by this? Folks will complain that some black folks, don't have a work ethic. Well, initially, we don't have an excuse today, but initially, it was to be understood, because why would you work anyway? You went from a slave owner to a sharecropper to effectively an indentured servant, and you didn't receive the benefits of your work on your own land. So what's the motivation to have a strong work ethic? Actually, just the opposite. One might sit in defiance of a slave owner and of a system that did not include you. But things have changed. Back to the story. What would have happened if we had outcomes for ourselves and not working so that someone else could get rich? Here is what Frank Rains, the former chairman and CEO of Fannie Mae, had to say about the power of economic equality for blacks. These are statistical facts, okay? If America had racial equality in housing, 3 million more African Americans would own their own homes. If America had racial equality in wealth, blacks would have $760 billion more in home equity value, $200 billion more in the stock market, $100 billion more in retirement funds, $80 billion more in the bank. By the way, I noticed on your program today are two executives from banks. When I finish, you will see why there should be 30 executives from banks at this session. I admire the vision of those who have committed already. The grand total of more than $1 trillion in financial wealth inequality demonstrates that the long journey of Black Americans from an enslaved people to full participation in our society is far from complete. More so, I love this, if this $1 trillion was an asset in Black hands in America, Blacks would effectively say, as I just said, it's okay if you don't love me, I love me. Or as my pastor and spiritual mentor, the Reverend Dr. Cecil Chip Murray, formerly of First AME Church, would say, it's not what people call you, it's what you answer to that's important. And never, ever, ever answer out of your name. And then I added, to argue with a fool proves there are two. Reminds me of a story. I'm gonna ask for permission just for the sake of making a point. I'm gonna ask you for permission for about 30 seconds to use the N-word. Trust me, there's relevance to it. You trust me?
Yes.
Right. There's a barbershop, Black barbershop in a southern town. Everybody goes to the barbershop. There's a parrot outside the barbershop. There's across the street a Black man and his child sitting having a conversation. A Black man walks up the walkway to the barbershop, and as he walks by, the parrot says, "Nigga." The man stops and turns around to look for somebody else. Before he gets his wits about him, the parrot says, "Dumb nigga." He turns and says, "Are you talking to me, nigga?" The parrot says. "Who are you talking to? Don't you know I'm a doctor? I have not one degree, but two. I'm also a business owner." He says, "Dumb nigga." He says, "You don't understand. I'm a businessman." Around this time, across the street, the father is looking at his son and says, "Will you look at that dumb nigga over there arguing with that parrot?" Y'all hard. That was funny. Look, if I'm walking down the street and somebody calls me a boy, a chump, a punk, the N-word, and I turn around, I am affirming that I am exactly what they told me. When you call my name, you have to say John Bryant. Or I'm not turning around. To argue with a fool proves there are two. I know I'm coming at you in a way that you're not used to. And unfortunately, I've only just begun. What we are doing wrong. Own something. Anything. Lease cars don't count. In 1920, African Americans owned 85 million acres of land. By 1985, we owned 3 million acres of land. According to Target Market News, a company that tracks Black consumer spending, Blacks spend a significant amount of their income on depreciable products. In 2002, the year the economy nosedived, we spent $22.9 billion on clothes, $3.2 billion on electronics, $11.6 billion on furniture to put into homes that in many cases were rented. Among our favorite purchases are cars and liquor. Blacks make up only 12% of the U.S. population, yet we account for 30% of the country's scotch consumption. Detroit, which is where I'm heading tomorrow night, so you know I'm gonna be all over them like a sheep suit. Detroit, they're opening an office in Detroit. Detroit, which is 80% Black, is the country's number one market for cognac. Prior to the civil unrest, and you know we don't know cognac factories. Prior to the civil unrest of 92, South Central LA had more liquor stores than 13 states combined. I have a quote that's in my book, Banking on Our Future. There's a difference between being broke and being poor. Being broke is an economic condition. Being poor is a disabling frame of mind and a depressed condition of our spirit, and we must vow never, ever, ever to be poor again. Right next to the liquor store, of course, is the payday lender and the check catcher. Now, I can't get mad at the payday lender and the check casher and the liquor store, because in order for them to have a viable business, they've got to have a customer. But because we're not investing in our future, because we have lost hope, where there is no vision, the Bible says, the people perish. We don't want to think about tomorrow. We just want to forget about today. And so we go to the liquor store to wash away our today. And then we go to the payday lender to forfeit our tomorrow. And then we go to the pawn shop, and then we leverage our yesterday. That's good news coming. But let me finish framing the issue. You with me?
Yes.
So impressed was Lincoln with the $46.7 billion that blacks spent on cars that the automaker commissioned Sean P. Diddy Combs, the entertainer and fashion mogul, to design a limited edition Navigator, replete with 6 plasma screens, 3 DVD players, and a Sony PlayStation 2. The only area where blacks seem to be cutting back on spending is books. We purchased $356 million in books in 2000 and $303 million in 2002. Go figure. What we need to know to do it right. We need to get on with the movement. My pastor, when he talking about I have a dream speech, my pastor, Reverend Murray, would also always say, the best way to start living your dream is to first wake up. In order for Black America to move forward, we need a bold, new, forward-thinking strategy for the 21st century, and I call that the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1968, as he launched his last initiative prior to his assassination, the Poor People's Campaign, which was about, by the way, poor whites. There's more poor whites in America than poor anybody else. Poor blacks, poor Latinos, poor Asians, poor Indians, moving them all up the economic ladder, because he said, and I quote, "You cannot legislate goodness, and you cannot pass a law to force someone to respect you. The only way to social justice in a capitalist country is through economic parity." And then I said in 1999, and I continue to say today, "You cannot pass a law to protect me from myself." I know some of you are a little confused about it right now. I'm giving a lot of information, but trust me, it will relate by the time we finish. Ambassador Andrew Young, the right arm to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as of November of last year, the national spokesman for Operation Hope. On April 12th of this year in Atlanta, Georgia, Ambassador Young and I will co-host a symposium, A Day of Hope with Andrew Young, from civil rights to silver rights, the dawning of a new movement in America. And what Ambassador Young will say, and he's already given me the verbiage of his quote, he's saying this over and over again so that everybody gets it. He said, "Martin and I," he can call him Martin, I have to call him Dr. King, "Martin and I succeeded in integrating the lunch counter and the public building and the schoolhouse, but never the dollar." And capitalism in a capitalist society with no access to capital is nothing more than a sophisticated form of slavery.
Yeah. No, you're right.
was and will be not just about money, but about wealth. You know, there's a difference between income and wealth. So it's not just about making more money, but making better decisions with the money you make. Do you know that if you're in high school and you get a part-time job making $1,000 a month and you practice what I call the 10% rule, which is you didn't make $1,000, you made $900. You didn't make $100, you made $90. You didn't make $50, you made $45. What am I doing taking 10% and investing it? If you practice the 10% rule, you make $1,000 a month from age 17 to age 45, you'll be worth $4.2 million. Didn't take you being a rap star or a basketball star or a movie star. You can be a trash collector. You can be a teacher. You can be a street cleaner. Martin Luther King also said, if you're going to be a trash collector, be the best trash collector the world has ever seen. Bridging the gap from civil rights to silver rights. What do we need? At least these four things. Number one, self-confidence, self-esteem, and personal responsibility. No one is going to save us but us. I tell folks to stop sending out engraved invitations to their pity party because ain't nobody coming. In 2005, everybody's got problems. The only difference is when mainstream America has a headache, black and brown folks have pneumonia, but we are all sick. Number two, education. In the 21st century, education is the ultimate poverty eradication tool. When you know better, you tend to do better. There's not a welfare mother in this country, in her right mind, who does not want her child to grow up to be successful, intelligent, hardworking, and tax-paying, if for no other reason than to feel proud of them. But you can't give what you don't have in a blind town or one-eyed man's king. If you don't know better, you cannot do better. It's what you don't know that you don't know that's killing you. It's what you don't know that you don't know that's killing you. It's what you don't know that you don't know that's killing you. We're not dumb and we're not stupid. It's what we don't know that we don't know. But we think we know. There's an old Southern saying. No matter how much I love you, my son or my daughter, if I don't have wisdom, I can only give you my own ignorance. And so out of love, we pass down bad habits from generation to generation. And then we get caught off on all these emotional journeys. My pastor, when we had private moments, he said, you know, black folks, we take the rain personal. If it's raining outside, that's about us. You know, because we've had so much pain in our lives. You know, we take the rain personal. And then he also said, you know, racism is sort of like rain. It's either falling someplace or it's gathering. So you might as well get out an umbrella in a color you like and start strolling through it because it's not going to change, so we must. I once asked a Klansman, well, why are you in the Klan? He said, well, my pappy was in the Klan. Okay, well, why was your pappy in the Klan? No, his pappy was in the Klan. Okay, we're getting somewhere. Well, why was your pappy's pappy in the Klan? Well, his great-grandfather co-founded the Klan. So I said, wait a minute now. So you don't consciously hate me. He didn't know how to respond to that. He said, well, you know, I never thought about it that way. I'm just doing what I does. Now, what's the lunacy of us focusing our energy? I'm going to hit you two times on this now. Focusing our energy on somebody who is not even aware why they dislike you. But even the Klan, you're not a full-time job. They get up in the morning, they go to their crappy job. They work from 9 to 5, they come home, they kick their dog, beat their wife, have a beer. About 8 o'clock, they come out looking for you. What are you doing the rest of the day? Waiting for them? Nobody can keep you down unless you stay down yourself. But let me even deeper. The Klan was created by the White Citizens Council. The White Citizens Council, ladies and gentlemen, wasn't personal, it was business. It was business people in the 1950s who saw the rise in population of blacks in the South and saw us moving to get rights to vote and other things and said our economic ownership and control of this market is at risk. So what did they do? They went to poor whites, whispered in their uneducated ear, and feeding in their fear said, they want your stuff. They want your wife, they want your daughter, they want your job, better go get them. And poor uneducated whites then organized what we call the Ku Klux Klan. The White Citizens Council faded into the background and nobody pays them any attention. And for 45 years, we've been rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic, fighting an enemy that doesn't even exist. Am I getting too deep here?
No.
You know, I can just come and I can just give you some economic theories. And, I mean, I can give you the easy speech. I'm Reverend, am I okay?
Oh.
Number three, true economic empowerment, ownership, a new class of stakeholders in America. Individuals that not only make more money, but make better decisions with the money they make. In South Central LA in 1992, 35% of the individuals in South Central owned their own home, 65% rented for the same cost of a mortgage payment. Now, you want to guess what the voter turnout rate was? 38%. Ladies and gentlemen, those weren't black homeowners. Those weren't brown homeowners. Those weren't white homeowners. Those were green homeowners. And when you become a homeowner, you become concerned about the potholes on your street, about the schools that may or may not be working, thank you. You become concerned with the incompetency on the city council, and you start wanting to do something because you have a vested interest in your community. When you become a homeowner, you become a taxpayer. When you become a homeowner, you become a venture capitalist with equity in your home to send your kids to college or to start a business. When you become a homeowner, you get what I call enlightened self-interest.
That's right.
When you become a homeowner, you get friends like banks who don't even know you, but like you. We need a new approach to living. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting a different outcome. We have got to become more proactive and more what I call principally pragmatic. That means whatever is honesty, has integrity, is in the spirit of the law and God and can get done. We should be focused on that and not what we call partisan politics. Now, in 2002, I was criticized. Now, why would I be criticized? I'm so meek. But we became the first nonprofit in history to host two U.S. presidents in 1 week. Now you think that was a reason for celebration. But we hosted President Clinton, our first black president, in in Harlem, where we went in a classroom and committed to educate every child in Harlem in financial literacy in 5 years. Then we went to South Central LA on April 29th, 10th anniversary of the riots, and I hosted President George W. Bush. And there was at least one congressperson who had something negative to say about me hosting the president. And they called me all kinds of things. Accused me of being a Republican, which I'm not. I'm a capitalist with a heart. Accused me of trying to turn everybody in my community into a Republican. I said, look, I'll turn you into an orange. It will help me improve my community. But I'm not trying to turn you into a Republican. But I believe a little competition, a good thing. They accused me of some other choice things. I said, wait a minute, slow down. Let me make myself clear. My community's in a crisis. So I don't really care whether you're black or white, rich or poor, conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat, if you want to help me eradicate poverty in my community, you are my friend. And if you don't, you are wasting my time. Let me become even more pragmatic. There's not six presidents. There's not three. There's one. And you better be talking to him if you have an opportunity to. You see where Clinton's hanging out, don't you? The way forward. The first thing we must do, and that's what I've been trying to kind of frame in the last 30 minutes, we've got to admit that we've got a crisis in our community. We don't have a problem, ladies and gentlemen. We have a crisis. We lead every negative indicator you can imagine. We keep going the way we're going. We're going to go the way the Indians. The only difference is we don't have reservations. And so that's why I have taken Bill Clinton into a classroom, Treasury Secretary John Snow, SEC Commissioner Paul Atkins, FDIC Chairman Don Powell, even Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, I took into a classroom to focus on the importance of financial literacy. Even Tyrese, so that the young people would listen to the message in new and different ways. And here's why. According to the Federal Reserve, 80% of the economy is on the back of the U.S. consumer. It's shocking. This is me and you buying coffee, filling up your gas tank, going to the grocery store, making your lease payments, making your house payments, I hope. This is normal, everyday activity. If we stop doing this, this economy comes to a grinding halt. Witness 9/11, post 90 days. Nobody bought anything anywhere. According to CNN in 2001, half of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. According to the Wall Street Journal in 2004, 70% of all Americans were living from paycheck to paycheck. Now, they didn't say 70% of black folks or brown folks, 70% of everybody. If you're living in California or New York and making less than $50,000 a year, if you're living in St. Louis making less than, my guess is, $40,000 a year, you are struggling just to make ends meet. Can I get an amen? The number one cause for divorce in America is money. According to the Department of the Treasury, more people filed for bankruptcy in 2002 than graduated from college in 2002. So then you say, well, at least we have our leaders for tomorrow. We've got our youth. Okay. Let me speak to that. In 1989, there were 289,000 non-business bankruptcy filers. By 2003, there were 1.7 million bankruptcy filers. And the largest group of bankruptcy filers were youth between 18 and 24. Now, let me give you a little piece of perverted good news. Those weren't black kids. This is perverted good news. Those weren't black kids. Those were middle class white college students getting a master's degree in psychology, an undergraduate degree in bankruptcy, paying for their pizza with a credit card, believe a check is a form of credit, and are calling home to mommy for more money. But as I said earlier, when mainstream America has a headache, black and brown folks have pneumonia. And so a third of all college students have no idea how they can make their first payment on their student loan. The average sophomore in college has $3,000 of consumer debt. God, we're at a college campus. Very appropriate. The average senior in college has four credit cards, $7,000 of consumer debt, and no job. The average senior graduates with $20,000 of combined debt. My wife, a brilliant lady, master's degree in interactive telecommunications, a bad sister. She still has not paid off her student loan. And she's doing well. So just imagine the average person and what they're going through. And so you've got 12 million adult households today that have no formal banking relationship. This is America. And so they do business with check cashers, pawn shops, payday lenders, and predatory lenders for mortgages. Now, here's the effect. More than $180 billion in annual financial transactions are conducted through check cashers, pawn shops, and pay their lenders. 180 billion. Now, the folks going to check cashers also have no history of home ownership. Guess where wealth was created in America when America was first started? Home ownership. Every economy goes through four stages: the agricultural age, the industrial age, the technology age, and the information age. The agricultural age requires land, folks, for a farm. And what's on that farm? But a home. Well, the industrial age requires also land to build a factory. You don't have to be smart, you need land. So by the time you get to the technology age, those who have had land have a heads up and an advantage on everybody else. I love giving the example in 2005 of how this impacted our lives. Let me illustrate for you. Harlem. Ladies and gentlemen, New York is an island. Land is finite. They aren't growing any more land. So you have Central Park, the Upper West Side of Manhattan, the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, Harlem. Okay, let me try that again. I didn't connect right. Let me try to be more basic, Reverend. White people, black people. Now, after a while, with increasing population and increasing wealth, after a while, white people say black people aren't so bad. Do you know that 10 years ago they'd have given you some land in Harlem? 5 years ago they paid you to take it. Today a tear down in Harlem is $500,000. And a townhome on 125th Street is $1 million. 10 years ago, there was a survey by black business people. 85% of business people said they didn't want a long-term lease. 10 years later, there's a survey of black business in Harlem, and now the landlord doesn't want you on a long-term lease. Why? Because they're leasing to Starbucks, and they're leasing to Best Buys and big box retailers who understood what we never understood. There's a market in our community. It's not a black community. It's not a brown community. It's an underserved community. You know, you've seen the Magic Johnson theaters, right? You say, oh, ain't that sweet? Ain't that sweet? You don't invest $40 million because you're sweet. You invest $40 million because you want to get paid. Black folks are 10% to 12% of the U.S. population, but we buy 25% of every movie ticket sold in this country. We go to the movies once, we go to the movies twice, we rent the video, we copy it. I just want to make sure you're awake. Operation Hope done about this? In 1992, we had a worst riot in U.S. history. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. And so we had a riot in South Central, and I decided to start America's first nonprofit social investment bank. And people said, nonprofit social investment bank, that's an oxymoron. And John, you're a moron. It'll never work. I'm 26 years of age. No one takes me serious. Everyone dismisses me. We had a $61,000 budget, one employee, and a vision to change the world. Today, Operation Hope has a $10 million annual operating budget, 80% of which is funded by the private sector. We have 250 bank, insurance company, credit union, and financial service partners with $3.6 trillion in assets between us. We have 100 CEOs on 7 boards of directors. We control 9 subsidiary operations operating in 10 states, 15 cities, and the District of Columbia. We have funded $130 million in loans to black folks and brown folks, creating 1,000 homeowners, 150 small business owners. In 11 years, not one home loan has ever gone bad. We have built Hope Centers in low-wealth communities. A Hope Center is a cross between a bank branch and a Kinko's for empowerment. One-stop shopping for changing your life. When you walk in the front door, there's a sign on the wall that says, no loans denied. Because we're more poor than we are broke. So the first thing we do is we give you your dignity back. We approve you day one, subject to the resolution of your primary denial factors. Then we work with you and we pull your credit report. You say, ooh, baby. It's like a bus accident, okay. But as Pastor Bobo would say, a saint is a sinner that got up. So, we then say, okay, we are what we are. But you weren't dumb and you weren't stupid. It's what you didn't know that you didn't know. So don't be ashamed, because everybody's got problems in 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, I used to have a secured credit card from the Bank of Hooven in 1985. I don't know anybody wants to admit in here they did business with the Bank of Hooven. But when you went into a restaurant, suffice to say, everybody knew that it was a credit card that had a $300 limit tied to a savings account with a $300 balance. And God help me if my $25 payment crossed in the mail, because I was gonna be declined for the dinner I was trying to buy for $23 to impress a lady that I was with out that night. I've lived this reality. Today I've got a black card from American Express. It's so rare, when you walk up to a counter, nobody even knows what a black card is. Don't tell me you can't go from zero to hero in one lifetime. So we built this Hope Center because people deserve dignity. And we work with you to resolve your credit issues, your financial issues. We give you financial CPR if we have to. Put some holy water on you. We put you in a credit counseling program and a case management program, and it's either 2 months or 2 years. But along the way, we say, don't you have a savings account? And you say, well, no, because I never save enough money to own a home, so why start? So we say, open a savings account. For every dollar you put up, we will grant you a dollar, up to $5,000, as long as you buy a home in a low-wealth area, the money is yours. We've done $400,000 of dollar-for-dollar matching grants. Where does the money come from? The money comes from banks. Why does banks donate money like that? Because it costs them $5,000 to market to secure a long-term customer. We say donate the money to us, you get a charitable credit, you get Community Reinvestment Act credit, and you'll get a new long-term customer. It's not about a hand out, it's about a hand up. I believe in the James Brown version of affirmative action. Open the door, I'll get it myself. And then you walk through the Hope Center program, and then we do thick file underwriting, copies of utility bills, copies of rent statements, copies of phone bills, because these are forms of credit that you do not get credit for on your electronic credit report. And so we work with you over 18 months, and when we finish with you, we increase your FICO score on average 100 points. And you know how hard that is to do. And by the time we finish with you, you are low-hanging fruit for every bank in town. The bank doesn't care whether you're black, white, brown, or yellow, because to you, to them, you now look green. And that is why, in 11 years, we've not had one loan default. Not one. In East St. Louis, where my mother grew up, in Detroit, south of 8 Mile, where I'm going tomorrow, I don't believe you should be going to a Hope Center. You should be going ultimately to a bank branch. So what we have said is, after 5 years of building this market up, a bank should come in and buy us out and put in a legitimate bank branch. People then said, John, you've really lost your mind. In 2002, we became the first nonprofit in history to build a bank branch and sell it to a bank. We have also educated 143,000 children in financial literacy, teaching children checking, savings, credit, investment, and the history of banking, because it's what they don't know that they don't know that's killing them. Do you know that we live in the largest capitalist country in the world and no one's teaching our children life 101 skills? It should be a crime, but no one's teaching our children the basics. I'm not talking about rocket science. I'm talking about the basics. What can you do here in St. Louis? Create a movement around youth financial literacy education. Get volunteers from banks and credit unions and insurance companies and other and investors, and get them to volunteer year-round to go into classes to teach children financial literacy. Everybody can make a difference. It doesn't have to be, don't sit here and think, oh, John Bryant's special. I'm not special. I got a GED out of high school. Chris Rock calls it a good enough diploma. Yes, I am dangerous now, but I'd be lethal with a college degree. And so everybody can make a change in their life. Now I know I bored you. And I know that it's about time for me to start wrapping up. And so let me come to the crux of my message. Do I have a few more minutes? Here's how we achieve the civil rights movement. Rule number one, you have to have an inspired perspective. This is so critical. You have to have an inspired perspective. Translation, be positive. The Bible says, where there is no vision, the people perish. The road ahead is not going to be easy. There's a book that is about Scott Peck. It's been on the bestseller list for 22 years. It's called The Road Less Traveled. The first line, the first sentence, the first page of this book states, life is difficult. Translation, if you can't get with that statement, don't read the rest of the book. Because nobody promised you a rose garden. Nobody promised you that life was going to be free of grief or pain. As I said to you earlier, you cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. It's a scientific fact that you cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. Life is 10% what life does to you, and 90% how you choose to respond to it. What's your response going to be? And whether you believe you can or whether you believe you can't, you're absolutely right. There's a story of a man. He went to Africa to sell shoes, and he cabled home immediately, bring me home. Why? No one here wears shoes. Then they sent a woman to Africa, probably my mother. She got there, immediately went into the bush, found them all. I know my mother. Stayed there 3 weeks. Came out of the bush. Cabled back to the home office. This is amazing. Send me 3 boatloads of shoes. The owner of the company said, you must have gotten malaria in the bush. What's come over you? She said, it's amazing. No one here wears shoes. The coffee's in the back. One can complain that rose bushes have thorns, or one can celebrate that a thorn bush has roses. Success has to be redefined in your life. Success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. Somebody said to me, well, I don't want to fail. Well, that's easy. You can't fall from the floor. In order to fail, you've got to succeed first.
Yeah.
And if you want to be an entrepreneur, understand this. an entrepreneur works 18 hours a day to keep from getting a job. As my friend Tom Mahoney, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, points out, there's a difference between being skeptical and being cynical. Be skeptical. Question everything. Question God. Question me. Question Reverend Bobo. But have hope. You know, there are three types of people, like three types of birds. There are eagles, there are buzzards, and there are turkeys. And eagles don't fly intact. You've never seen a flock of eagles. An eagle even raises their children differently. An eagle's nest has sharp little twigs. Message. If you get big enough, when you're pushing up against the inside of that nest, you better get up and go get a job. Talking about you 49 years old living with your mama. And then you got, an eagle's a high altitude bird. Not arrogant, not pompous, but there's certain dignity and a regalness to an eagle. And then you got low altitude birds, buzzards. Buzzards love pats. Buzzards are always stepping on somebody else's head to elevate themselves. Buzzards are always player hating, never player congratulating. Always got something negative to say about somebody. Well, who's he think he is? And why is he up there? Do you know it takes 35 muscles to frown and 7 muscles to smile? Why are we frowning all the time? It takes work to be a miserable person. I know y'all ain't never inviting me back. That's it. That's cool. I'm here now. And then you got the worst kind of bird. The worst kind of bird is a turkey. Because a turkey's got wings and can't even fly. All they do is crow fight. If I see one more brother with baggy jeans and a white t-shirt corner in every inner city community in America, I will blow my own brains out. It's driving me out of my cotton picking mind. Trying to be something you are not. Translation. Parking your leased Cadillac on the front lawn of your rented apartment building. The second rule of the civil rights movement is to believe in people. You don't do business with companies or governments or communities, you do business with people. It's about relationships. Don't go to networking conferences, stop it. You never see Bill Gates at a networking conference. The only people at a networking conference is somebody who wants to sell you something. The question is not what you can get from me. The question is, what can you share with me, give me, what can we do for each other? It has to be a reciprocal relationship. It can't be about, you know, a handout. It can't be a closed fist. It has to be an open hand. And so understand there's 6 billion people in the world and nobody just like you. I don't understand why everybody wants to bounce a ball like Michael Jordan, to dance like Michael Jackson, God forbid, to look like Dennis Rodman. I don't understand it. I don't understand it. We treat our personal computers better than we treat our own bodies. There are 6 billion people in the world. There's nobody like you. There are lawyers and bankers and all kind of categories. But why do you do business with a certain person? Why do you go to this man's church? Why do you come to this conference? It was your belief in a person. Somebody inspired you. Somebody you believed in compelled you to come here. So the thing that you've got to sell is you. One person can make a difference. One of my mentors in Japan told me, he said, John, I'm going to tell you the purpose of life. I said, wow, let me sit down. He said, no, for you, just takes a minute. So he said the whole purpose of life is to become transparent to God's will.
Yes.
Woo! So simple. I said, well, how do I do that? He said, learn to get out of your own way. How often? Every single day. And for those who believe that this is a black problem or a brown problem, I got two things to say to you. 75% of all children today under the age of 10 are ethnic minority children. Now you let that sit for a minute. That's America of the future. All right? That's point number one. Point number two, my friend Ron Kirk, former mayor of Dallas, said this. You can take no pleasure from the fact that there's a hole in my end of our boat. Boy, I'm using my best stuff on y'all today, and it's just, I mean, it's rule number three, make the connection. I talked to you and framed in minute detail the economic realities, but let me tie it in for you. The largest capitalist country in the world today is the United States of America. The largest market is the United States of America in the world. The only nation in the world where every race of people is within its borders is the United States of America. Okay, you say nice coincidence. Okay. The two largest economies in the United States of America are California and New York. The two most ethnically diverse places in the United States of America are California and New York. And I know the joke. There was an earthquake, the world tilted to one side, all the nuts rolled to California, but it is still the fifth largest economy in the entire world, California. Now guess where the 10th largest economy is in the entire world? Los Angeles County. 176 different ethnic groups. The largest population of Koreans outside of Korea. More Chinese American in Southern California than any place else outside of China, in the United States. It is the celebration of diversity. Diversity is not a goody two-shoes issue. Diversity is a business issue. You shouldn't be saying to corporations, put blacks and browns on your board of directors and in your management team because it looks good. No. Do it because it is good. Good for your bottom line. Because if you can't do business with people who are black, brown, and different, you're going to have an increasing pie of a decreasing share. This is not about, this is not personal. This is business. The business of diversity. Some of my black brothers and sisters get mad at my Latino friends. The largest condiment seller in the nation for generations has been ketchup. It's now salsa. I tell my black brothers and sisters, you better learn to put some salsa on your barbecue. And don't get mad for them coming back to California. They just come to get their stuff. Do your history. By the way, what do you think Puerto Rican is? If not too black to be Spanish and too Spanish to be black. Where do you think slaves came from? There were slaves in Mexico before there were ever slaves in the United States. Don't get it twisted. Let's not rearrange the deck chairs of the Titanic by fighting with each other, fighting over crumbs on a table with a three-course meal. All right, I'm bringing this home. At the end of the day, we got to convert check cashing customers into banking customers. That's why Operation Hope, we hate check cashers. I'm on record. We bought a check casher. The largest in South Central LA, 600,000 customers. Why? If you can't beat them, buy them. And we partnered with the largest bank in domiciled in California. And do you know today, we are responsible for 10% of all deposits of that bank year over year. They opened 40,000 accounts last year in 6 states. We opened 4,000 accounts in South Central Los Angeles. Converting renters into homeowners, converting small business dreamers into small business owners, moving people up and out of poverty. Let's stop looking at our inner city communities as wastelands, moving uptown to places that we rent and giving up downtown to places that we own. Understand this. Understand this, ladies and gentlemen. They are not growing any more land. Now, South Central LA used to just be called LA. When white America lived there. You know that President Bush's father lived in Compton, California in 1958? It was a white bedroom community. Look, South Central LA is 15 minutes from the freeway, 15 minutes from the port, 15 minutes from the mountain, 15 minutes from downtown. It's not a black community, it's centrally located real estate. Yo, people say, oh well, you know, Pittsburgh, it's a smokestack city. No, it's not. That was 30 years ago. What did I say? The agricultural age, the industrial age, the technology age, the information age. In the industrial age, where's the worst land in Pittsburgh? Next to the lake, on the hill. Why? Because they pollute the lake, the factories, and the smokestacks pollute the air. So where do they put poor people? Next to the lake, on the hill. You guys with me? You might say you're gonna write me a check. I'm sorry, I'm preconditioned to hear that. I'm sorry. So, what happened today? We live in a clean economy. We live in the information age. Guess where the best land in Pittsburgh is? Next to the lake, on the hill. But what did they do to black people? Did they force us out? Did they come with hoods on and flames and say, you gotta get out of here? No. They came with a $1,500 check and said, don't you wanna move out of this dump? And because we have no vision, we said, can't wait. $250,000 townhomes they are building right now, next to the lake. On the hill. Don't you know folks are tired of driving an hour to get to work? Go to Detroit downtown these days and look at the lofts they are building downtown Detroit. Harlem's gone, folks. It's gone. Unless we do something drastic, in 10 years, Harlem will be 2 homes with a sign on it that said black folks once lived here. We didn't. No. White folks didn't do it to us. Racism didn't do it to us. We gave it away. Everybody can make a difference. You got to be a little crazy to have this conversation. But you know what? There were some crazy people. They said Jesus Christ was crazy. Nelson Mandela was out of his cotton-picking mind. Wait a minute, you're going to go to jail, an angry black man. Stay there 27 years. You're going to come out and hug your jailer. And then proclaim you're going to become the first black president of South Africa. You become the first black president of South Africa. Turn around and make your jailer your vice president. How you like me now? Martin Luther King was crazy. By the way, he walked with Jews. Had a slight theological disagreement about a man named Christ. But he said, let's not get into that. Let God sort it out. My guess is God doesn't have a self-esteem problem. You can call him whatever you want. Let him, so who amongst us is that good and that smart. Let's focus on the thing we can agree on. That's why I'm talking to President George W. Bush. Because I'm not focused on Iraq. I'm not focused on the thing that we may have intelligent disagreement. By the way, you can disagree without being disagreeable. And so, his ownership society, I'm down with that. How can we create more owners in my community? That's the conversation I wanted. Black America needs to be talking to everybody that's at 1600 Pennsylvania. I don't care whether they're Republican, Democrat, or an orange. We need a new agenda. And so here is what I suggest. If the 20th century was about race and the color line all over the world, or what we call civil rights, and if the first civil right was the right to vote, not only in southern states in America, but in apartheid South Africa. You know, race has been an issue. We don't have a lock on racism. You know, the caste system in India. You know, you got dark Japanese in Japan. They're out in the prefectures. They're farmers. They're poor. The light Japanese run Japan. Do you know the mestizo in Mexico? The mestizo, the dark Indian looking, darker, because they're mixed with the Indian and the Spaniard. By the way, the Indian came over the Bering Strait from Asia. All related. But those are the folks that are running over the border trying to get here for a better life. The Spaniard who conquered Mexico is doing just fine in Mexico. So race has been an issue all over the world. So if the 20th century was about race and the color line all over the world, what we call civil rights, and if the first civil right was the right to vote, then the 21st century is going to be about issues of class and poverty. And the first silver right of the 21st century is financial literacy. Because if you don't know better, you cannot do better. Education is the ultimate poverty eradication tool. When you know better, you do better. And when you're educated, you feel better about yourself. And when you feel better about yourself, you have high self-esteem. And when you have self-esteem, you say, it's okay if you don't like me, I like me. And so I'm done. But let me leave you with this. And thank you for the time. I hope I haven't wasted any of your Let's assume none of this has impacted you in any way. Let's assume I put you to sleep. Let's assume that there's no blood running through your veins whatsoever and I am completely underwhelming you. Let's assume that for the moment. And I say to you this. You don't get any credit from God for being a nice person. You don't get any credit for showing up to work on time. You don't get any credit for being pleasant, for smiling, for raising your children. You don't get any credit for putting a roof over their heads, for paying the mortgage. You don't get any credit for being kind to your neighbor, for showing up on church and tithing. You're supposed to do those things.
Hallelujah.
I love Chris Rock. He's funny, but he's also a bit of a prophet. He said once, a guy came up to me and said, I ain't never been to jail. He says, well, you're not supposed to go to jail. The guy wanted credit for not going to jail. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't get credit for what you're supposed to do. You only get credit from God for helping other people. And I don't know about you, but I want a spiritual platinum card with no limit on it. If I was a guy focused on me, myself, and I, making money, getting paid, riding around in my private jet, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if I had took that route, I could have done all that.